Hi, welcome to Lady Business Plus. I'm here with Courtney Schaefer, who I have dubbed kind into being on the podcast. Hey, how you doing?
Hey, everybody. This is Courtney Schaefer, and if I sound like I spend way too much of my time drinking whiskey and standing around in smoky bars, it's because I'm getting over the worst cold ever. But I am prepared with cider for this podcast.
We almost got derailed by our illnesses. You got a super horrible cold. I'm developing a cold. The world did not want this podcast to happen. They were like, nope.
I know, but we triumphed anyway. We're talking despite our various illnesses, and
we have water and cider and tissues, and we're prepared.
Yes.
So thank you for coming on. I'm glad that I didn't intimidate you into not coming on. Apparently, I was like, I'm super scary in my email about it.
No. I am happy to be here. I am happy to talk about genre stuff, and I love doing it. So
you write books. You write fantasy books. And why don't you tell us a little bit about both of your books?
Okay, well, I write what I like to call adventure fantasy, and I call it that because it's somewhere on the scale between epic fantasy and sword and sorcery, not quite one thing or the other, but it does have a lot of adventures, so that's the adventure fantasy. The series is called The Shattered Sigil, and the first book is The Whitefire Crossing. The second book is The Tainted City, and those are the two that are published right now. The third one, The Labyrinth of Flame, will be coming out sometime in either this next year or, if I'm unlucky, the year after that. Basically, they're kind of the story of two guys. One is a mountain climber who smuggles illegal charms on the side, and the other is a mage who's on the run from a powerful enemy. They end up being forced to make this wilderness journey together, and they kind of develop a reluctant friendship, and they get caught up in a whole series of events that neither of them had realized that their actions were affecting, and adventures ensue. So if you like books by people like, let's see, Carol Berg or Martha Wells or in the Guy Zone even, who else, Brandon Sanderson, that kind of thing, I think you might like mine.
It was an excellent elevator pitch. You did much better than I can ever do trying to describe any story that I write.
Well, you know, I am not good with the pitch, I have to admit. This is why when I queried people, agents and the like, I never did that thing where you pitch in person. Oh, my goodness. I liked the query letter because you could write it out and you could stare at it and you can tinker it and you can, you know, make it just exactly right and then send it. So these people who are all anxious to go meet agents at conferences and things like this, I'm like, are you kidding?
How do they do that? Do you just do the agents like have a table, or do you just walk up to them cold and do it? Because I would have a nervous breakdown.
Well, it kind of depends on the conference, right? Like, if you go to a writing conference, like I often go to the Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers Conference here in Denver, the Colorado Gold Conference. That type of conference will have specific set aside times for people to pitch agents, like pitch appointment, I guess it's called, where you go into a room where it's just you and the agent, and you have like 15 minutes or 20 minutes or something like that, and you pitch the agent your book. You should see, I mean, people are like shaking and terrified and throwing up and all this kind of stuff. And I was just like, you know, why would you do that to yourself? Because for me, it would be, you know, the shaking and terrified and throwing up. I mean, some people really are good at talking extemporaneously or even just preparing first and talking about their book. And so it is a way to kind of make a personal connection with an agent. I have to say, I liked my route better, where I went to that conference. But what I did was I signed up for a critique workshop where there were like 8 of us in the workshop, and we sent, I think, the first 10 pages plus a synopsis of our book to the agent ahead of time. And the agent read everybody's pages. And then during the workshop, we all read each other's pages too. The agent critiqued, you know, everybody's pages. And then we all went around the table and gave our own critique too. And that's actually how I met my agent. I signed up for the workshop with her because I was looking at the various agent bios, and the one person that said they did epic fantasy, this is, you know, back in, I don't know, like 2008 or something like that, when urban fantasy was really big, and so hardly anybody was doing epic fantasy. And the other agents, only one of them said that they did epic fantasy, and I'd already queried them and been rejected. So I was like, well, who do I sign up for? And my agent, Becca Stumpf, a prospect literary, she said in her bio that she reread A Wrinkle in Time every year. And I was like, ooh, I love Madeline L'Engle. I read her all, you know, I love those books as a child, and I still love them now. So I signed up for her workshop. And it turned out she loved my first 10 pages and everything. And so she asked for the full of Whitefire Crossing right there on the spot, like, you know, at the end of the workshop. Now, lest you think this is a totally happy ending, it sort of wasn't in that, oh, the book was so not ready at that time. It did not have enough tension and all this. And I figured that out by joining a critique group and getting critique and all this. And so eventually, when Becca hadn't responded to the full, I sent her, you know, an email to kind of poke her. And she actually, she ended up calling me about the book. And she was like, you know, I really like this, but it's not quite there yet. And I was like, I know, I'm rewriting it right now. And so I did. I rewrote it, and then I ended up sending her the, you know, the completely rewritten, new and improved and shiny version, and that's when she made an offer of representation and became my agent. But I met her first through that critique workshop, and like I said, it was kind of low stress because I didn't have to explain my book to her or anything like that. She'd read the pages. She'd read the synopsis. So I thought that was a much more fun way to do it than having to talk cold about your book. But there are people – like, I just went to WorldCon this year.
I know. And I heard all about it and got pictures and was made to feel super jealous. Thanks a lot, Justin, for that feeling, whatever he's
yes,
great.
Well, and Justin was busy facilitating everybody to meet the agents and, you know, talk to them about their book. Because at WorldCon, there's not that, you know, I'm going to go pitch the agent now thing. It's just you kind of have to, like, I don't know, hang out with them at the bar or something. And a lot of people, even people who do feel comfortable about their books, are kind of intimidated, you know, going up to an agent at a bar, right? So Justin, it was actually kind of awesome about helping people meet agents and feel comfortable talking to them and then talking about their book. And so I know some people who are excited about the contacts they made that way. But like I said, I always preferred the written route.
You say you it was a critique group, and you have a critique group, and you talk about this critique group to me quite often. I'm really interested in this because I don't really have, I don't know if you can call fandom, like people in fandom, a critique group in the same way you call like an actual critique group you go to and give them like original stuff the same. Like, I don't know if they're really similar or if they work the same way. So could you talk about your critique group and like what they do for your work?
Sure. And really it's the same thing, I would think, is what you're doing with people in fandom. You're reading each other's stuff and giving feedback on it. It's just everybody kind of does the formal critique group thing a slightly different way. Mine, I totally lucked into because that same workshop where I first showed those first 10 pages of the Whitefire Crossing to Becca, there was another writer in the workshop who happened to really like my first 10 pages also. And she was like, oh, hey, you know, I'm part of this critique group that has like Carol Berg and all this in it, and would you like to join us? And I was like, oh my God, Carol Berg, because, you know, Carol was one of my absolute favorite longtime fantasy authors and everything. So I was so nervous when I showed up to the, you know, to the group. They basically, what this group does is they've been together for ages and ages. Most of them are veteran authors who first published in, like, I don't know, the late 80s or something like that. I mean, Carol actually, I think, first published in like 2000 or whatever. But anyway, the point being, they've all been writing for a long time. They've all been together for a long time in this critique group. And the way they do it is you meet every 2 weeks roughly in person, and each person in the critique group can hand out a chapter. Not everybody's writing all at once. Like, people are at different stages of, I just finished a book, or I'm revising a book, or I'm whatever. The point is you hand out a chapter ahead of time and everybody reads it and makes notes on it, like on a printout. But then when we meet in person, then you go around and everybody kind of says what they thought about the chapter and goes through their notes as they go. And so we do it in person that way. But I know plenty of other people who do it online, or just by exchanging Word documents with track changes. You know, there's a million ways to do critique and have it work for you. But like I said, I was so nervous because, I mean, not only to go and hand your stuff over to somebody who's been one of your favorite authors for a long time, but also to have to, like, speak intelligently on their draft. Oh my goodness. Thankfully, by now, I guess I've been a member of the critique group since whenever that was. I'm trying to think now, 2008, something like that. Yes, 2008. So in all this time, I have gotten over my fangirl gushingness. But really, I can't emphasize enough how much they help me. And part of that was because they are, I guess, veteran authors. So there's a skill to critique like everything else, right? And I imagine that people in fandom probably have developed a pretty good skill at this also, because the more critique.
Your group sounds like, are they nice, or or do they, like, do they get rough? Because I'm used to, like, some, like, you know, my friend Rose going, saying, I'm Michelle, going, you use too many commas, Renee. Why do you hate commas so much? Stop it. Stop sucking with your commas. So, like, that's what I'm, like, I'm, don't suck, Renee. Don't, like, that's kind of what suck. I'm, like, that's what I'm used to with my writing. Like, I don't know. Like, and then I have my friend Ira, who, the last time she edited for me, like, her edits were longer than my piece.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, in our group is, what's the right term? Like, blunt, but tactful, if such a thing is possible. Like, there was one guy who used to be very, very blunt, you know. Unfortunately, he passed away. He had melanoma. So a year or so after I joined the group or whatever, but he was a hard science fiction guy. And, I mean, his critique was really valuable because it came from a different place than a lot of us write fantasy. And so it is kind of useful to have somebody who comes from a completely different, because he was really Mr. Hard Science Fiction. He didn't read very much fantasy and whatever, but he has a different mindset. And so coming in, he could spot things about, inconsistencies in the magic systems and this and that kind of thing that maybe the rest of us would have glossed over. But anyway, he was, you know, definitely of the little bit more of the, you know, this character is dumb. But the point is, he would always say, like, this character is dumb, not you are dumb. You know what I mean? There's a pretty big difference. And so they're all like that. I mean, they're not going to let me get away with anything. But at the same time, the critique is always of the words on the page, not of me as the writer. You know what I mean?
No, that makes sense.
And so that I mean, it can be hard. I mean, there's definitely times when all of us, I've seen all of us, like, turn stuff in, and, you know, you can see the rules that we have is that the person being critiqued has to be quiet while all the other people talk. And then at the end, you get a chance to, like, respond to what they've said, or, you know, ask further questions or whatever. But, you know, we've all had those moments where you're sitting there and, like, person after person is just, like, ripping apart your chapter, and you're, like, going inside. And, you know, just because, I mean, it is your writing, right?
It's soul crushing. Especially, that's what you're saying.
Yeah. But at the same time, like I said, as long as they're saying, hey, this doesn't work, not you are dumb, you know, you can't write, you know, then that's the kind of critique that's valuable. And even if it's hard, actually, I think it's only hard when it's true, because there's definitely other times when people go around, I don't get this, I don't, you know, whatever. And now if everybody doesn't get it, then you've got a problem, right? But if one person says, oh, gosh, I totally didn't get this, or I didn't like this, but the other people thought it was fine or whatever. But there are times when you know when they said that the critique is not, that it's not applicable, or that it's not what you want to do or whatever. And then it's easy to brush aside. But when it's hard is when they say something and you get all defensive and you're like, no, that character was doing this and you didn't get it. You know, but what that means is there's something wrong and you need to fix it. And it may not be the thing that everybody else is pointing out immediately. It might be something that you're not coming clear through enough with the character motivation or whatever. But the point is that when you get all defensive, you know that there's something, there's something there. And that's hard. But at the same time, what's really cool is after you get all defensive and you have your little time of blah, then later you start thinking, oh, well, wait a minute. I know how I could fix that. Oh, I have this great idea, you know, and then, working on it that way afterward, I always know that the chapter is so much better because I spent that time to work on it. And so that's why it's so awesome. So hooray for people who give feedback, whether they are in fandom or, you know, authors or critique or whatever.
Because people who give feedback, yeah, when it's too late, the book is published. That's me.
Well, no, but even then, right? I mean, I know some authors don't read the reviews.
But you do, which is a great.
Oh, yes.
Why do you do this? This seems, I don't even read my reviews. And generally in fandom, it's not a done thing to, like, rip apart fanfic. And I won't even go, like, read commentary anymore. Like on Pinboard or Delicious or AO3 Bookmarks. I won't even do that, because I'm just like, nope, can't do it. Don't want to see it. Can't handle it. So you do it all the time, and then you link to people, and then you, like, befriend the people who just, like, took your book and stomped on it, like you did me. Like, here we are on this podcast. And
I know that now that I think about it, I'm like, that's true. I think Renee's review was probably,
I was an asshole.
No, you weren't an asshole. You just, I mean, you pointed out some things that were things in the book, right? I guess you were probably one of the more critical reviews that I had of Whitefire. And yet here we are talking like friends. And I actually think that's awesome, because, like I said, it only hurts if it's true. I mean, I guess that's not. I mean, if somebody's making a personal attack on you, it's going to hurt. And it's
no,
not.
No, I'm sorry.
Be true,
I've
but,
read plenty of,
you know,
reviews of your books that have just been wrong. I mean, they're entitled to their wrong opinion, but they're just wrong.
Maybe so. But I guess the way that I look at it is, if if the reviewer is saying something that I'm like, well, that's not right, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then I'm like, I have to think about it. I have to think, well, why did they come away with that impression of the book that was not the impression that I wanted, you know, the person to have? And sometimes you just have to say, well, you know, people give different interpretations. But other times you have to sit and think, well, was there a way that I could have made that more clear? Was there a way that I could have written the scene so that that interpretation that I had wanted to convey out of that scene would have been more clear? And granted, you can't do anything about the book that's already on the shelf, but you can do the one, something about the book that you're running now. And so that's why I, well, that's not entirely why I read my reviews. I read my reviews because the whole reason I set out to be published was because I wanted to share my stories with people. And so just having that feedback that like, hey, people are out there reading my story. And even if they didn't like everything about the story, or even if they didn't, you know, I don't know, it doesn't matter so much to me what the actual reaction is. Just the idea that my story went out there and somebody read it and had their own interpretation of it. That to me is the whole point of why I'm going through all these publishing hoops. So I admire the authors that don't read any of the reviews. I'm sure they're probably more mentally well adjusted, but I really like having that feedback. And there are times when I have to say, no, I'm not going to read reviews for a little while. Just because when you're really stressed with a deadline coming up a book, like with writing Tainted City, I had to stop for a little while just because every time I got a good review of Whitefire, I'd be like, oh no, what if I can't make Tainted City as good? And what if nobody likes it as much? And what if I disappoint everybody? And if I got a bad review, which, you know, then of course done, then that makes you feel bad anyway. So I just had to be like, okay, I'm going to back away for a little bit until I get this book done. But then when I did, I went back and read all the reviews that I hadn't read during that time. So
that's helping. That was a good life choice.
Yeah, or something. I swear this business is really, really hard on the mental health. So when people are like, what's your one advice you would give to aspiring authors? I'm like, get yourself as mentally healthy as possible because you're going to need it.
Self-care. That's what I call it. That's how I talk to my staff on my committee in the OTW. Like, self-care 2013.
Exactly. Like, you got to figure out a way that you can deal with stress a pretty bulletproof way and make sure that you know it and that you have it ready.
So, and when you were talking about your critique group, you mentioned that one of the people that critiqued you was into hard SF. And so what made you choose to like write fantasy rather than science fiction? Because I know you're an engineer, and right. I really want you to come and write some science fiction because I'm just greedy.
Well, there are two reasons for it. One is that I kind of feel like I do science fiction already in my day job. When I come home, I kind of want to use my brain in a different way. That's not to say, I mean, I'm not saying I would never write a science fiction story, but I'm just saying that that's why I naturally gravitate towards fantasy in what I write. Because, yeah, I mean, if you feel like you're doing the hard sci-fi all day in your job working in the space industry, then I already do that, so I don't need to do it again. But that said, the other reason is also just that for my day job, they don't care what I write if it's fantasy, but if I was writing science fiction, especially hard science fiction, there would, you know, I'd have to go through a document review process, and I don't know, it would be a big pain. So if I had a story idea that I was like, oh, I must write this, ooh, science fiction, it, you know, it would totally be doable. They would work with me on it, but it's just easier to write fantasy. So
you could be like Martha Wells and write, they call her stuff science fantasy. I've seen that term thrown around a lot in reference to the Cloud Roads and the Raxura. Is that how you pronounce it? Her book series?
I think she says Raxura. Raxura.
Well, so, but yeah, but those have they have science fiction and fantasy elements, so they're calling them science fantasy. I have seen more than one person refer to them that way. So you could do that. That's an option.
Oh, yeah. You know, and honestly, I always think it's kind of funny that people make this big deal about distinguishing between fantasy and science fiction. I never really cared until I got published. And then people would be like, what genre do you write? What genre is your book in? You know, and that's important for marketing reasons. But before then, I don't know, it was all speculative fiction to me. And I read it all and, you know, everything from hard science fiction to epic and historical fantasy and just everything. And yeah, I didn't care. So I'm happy to read it all. And like I said, if I had an idea for something that was science fictional, I would write it that way. But, you know, the other attraction of fantasy, I have to say, is that it does give you more, to me, a little bit more freedom, I think, in what you can do. Now, science fantasy would kind of be the same way, I guess, because there, again, you're kind of making up your world without having to be constrained by what real world technology and real world understanding of the laws of physics is.
And math.
Right, and math. But yeah, one of the things I like so much about fantasy is that, I mean, you can do anything, right? If you want to have gods, if you want to have magic, if you want to have people who can shapeshift, like in Martha's books, really, you know, you can, anything you want. I mean, you have to make it internally consistent or else the reader's going to get upset. But that's, again, part of the fun, kind of, I guess, the engineering part of it for me is, you know, figuring out the rules to work everything out and figure out how it all work in my world and all this. And in that sense, that's kind of similar, I guess, between how people write science fiction and how people write fantasy. But even if people are thinking of fantasy as different, that effort is still there in the world building, you know, making it internally consistent, figuring out what can this magic user do? What can that one do? What, you know, what are the restrictions on their magic? That kind of thing.
I've only started to recently divide them. Obviously, I'm really new to science fiction. The fandom, that is. Like, the way I think of science fiction fandom, like, starting back in the 1920s, where it's moved up since then, that particular fandom that's huge and sprawling. But then I came from, like, Final Fantasy, like, Sailor Moon and Final Fantasy and up that way. And it's like, with Final Fantasy, and I don't know if you've ever played Final Fantasy games. Have you ever...
My husband was totally into one of the Final Fantasies, so I have, I'm sure the music to it is still stuck in my head somewhere, but I have not personally played them, but I have seen him play whichever one it was, which I'm trying to remember.
Well, I've played like 6 through 13 at this point, and several of the spinoffs. I was big into that fandom. Part of my problem with, like, dividing science fiction and fantasy now that I'm more into, like, the book fandom, is that, like, in Final Fantasy, you have, like, these worlds that have magic. But then, like, in Final Fantasy VIII, you would have, like, these super techie worlds or cities. And Final Fantasy VII did it. All those Final Fantasies, it was more steampunk. Then, like, you had Final Fantasy XIII. And they have Final Fantasy in the title, but a lot of them are what I would think of as science fiction. So that's why I have really a hard time when people are, like drawing these really distinct lines between, like, hard SF and whatever comes after, like, whatever's below hard SF, and then the science fiction that I think I like to read, like John Scalzi flavored science fiction. And I don't know why the distinctions are there. Like, why are we? I haven't figured out why we continue to divide them so much. If you're that interested in science, go read that textbook. I get so upset. I'm like, I don't want Matt. Like, I tried to read Greg Egan's.
Greg
Clockwork
Egan.
Rocket, I think is what it was called. Uh-huh. And I was just like, are you fucking joking, dude? Really? Banned. I'm like, no, you're not allowed in my brain. I'm like, just no. So I'm really not into, like,
my
the
Caltech
SF
friends
stuff.
Thought Greg Egan is, like, the best writer ever. You know, my physicist friends or whatever, they're just like, oh my gosh, his math, it's so wonderful.
His
but yeah, I hear you.
Jump off a cliff. I get enough of that, like, at work when I'm trying to, like, do change in my head when I have a line and everything's beeping. Like, I just don't. That's my limit on math. I don't need it in my fiction.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the distinctions, the attempts that people make to distinguish, actually kind of come from our instinct to, if people ask for recommendations, right? Like, you know, if it's a way to kind of quantify down to say, hey, well, are you looking for more like this? And like this could mean hard science fiction or steampunk or alternate history or, you know, whatever, right? You try to kind of lump books together so that you can say, hey, if you like this one, you might like this one too. That's some of what, of course, I guess humans just like to categorize, but I also think that that's some of why there's this enduring trying to split hairs all the way down to the exact genre of any given book, because people like to put books together.
I'm so bad at genre. I'm just terrible at it. It's like, the only thing I know I can't read is hard SF, and I'm never going to be able to read hard SF. I'm just like, although a lot of people have been putting Ancillary Justice in the hard SF category, I'm kind of like, really? I mean, really, there's no math here. I get really confused about some of the categorizations of something. Because, like, I have this really specific idea of hard SF as, like, that I'm too dumb for. But I wasn't too dumb for Ancillary Justice. I got that. It took me 130 pages, but I got it.
Ancillary Justice goes in the, what would you call it, the social science SF, right? Talking about questions of culture and gender. And I think... although I personally wouldn't have called it hard SF, because I guess a little bit like you, I tend to think of that more as the SF of physics and math. I think that there's an argument to be made that, well, you know, dealing with the social sciences is just as much science, right? So, and goes back to, I guess, the thing about women writing science fiction, that traditionally There have been a lot more women writing in the social science area of science fiction. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't women who write the mathematical, physical science fiction, and that there aren't men who write, you know, social science fiction. But I guess that perception of, well, it's not science fiction because it's whatever, right, can kind of apply to this, should we call ancillary justice hard SF or not. Like I said, it wouldn't be in my personal categorization or whatever. I wouldn't recommend it to people necessarily as being diamond hard SF, but I would definitely call it, you know, social science SF.
Oh, I think there needs to be like a cheat sheet for this. I get so stuck. But I
you
mean,
know,
I wouldn't
it
read...
doesn't matter. Books are good, right? That's the important thing. If you say this book is awesome,
that's pretty much what how I got. Like, all I need is my Twitter feed to be like, this book is great, and I'm probably gonna end up looking into it. The only reason I started to do the genre divide, I think, is because, I mean, I've come out of fandoms that are pretty dude-heavy, like the science fiction and fantasy fandoms that I was in, like, in the early, the late 90s or early aughts. So I just wanted to, I tied this conversation with, I think, Jody once about how, and, like, when I'm doing, like, when I'm in fandom, I really enjoy, like, stories about, I don't mind men in the story so much because then you can, like, go and remix them and queer the texts and like do your own thing. But like in original work, I'd rather have women. And I've noticed that when I first was asking for a science fiction recommendation, I noticed that people like they gave me recommendations that were about women. So I think I just missed the like the hard SF train because people were just like they were tailoring their recommendations to female characters. So maybe that's what's happened. I'm just never gonna be able to like reconcile myself with hard SF. I'm never gonna be a Greg Egan fan. Sorry, Greg Egan. I failed science and math and all my courses in college and high school.
I think it's interesting what's happened with hard SF recently. I mean, it's definitely, I think, shrunk a little bit as a genre because hard SF is propelled a lot by technological advances, right? And we haven't had any really big leaps forward in the way that we had during, I don't know, what do they call it, the golden age of science fiction or whatever, for a while. And most of the technological leaps that we have had have been more in the area of communication and, you know, the internet and social sciences and things like this. So that's where I think science fiction has sort of gone to a little bit more in this day and age. And focusing more on things like cryptography and privacy and how we're dealing with the impact of these communication technologies on our lives. And that's not to say that people aren't still writing, you know, the classic, I guess, let's change physics and see how that affects the universe science fiction, because they are. But I think there's less of a push for it. Now, as soon as we make some kind of new technological leap, then I think that'll happen. It may be more in, you know, biology. Like there have been a lot of people, right, like writing recently about sort of biological science fiction.
I'm really bad at recommendations and like paying attention to new stuff. Sorry.
Yeah, but what I mean is it's kind of shifting a little bit more towards biology, social science, and whatever than it had been toward physics and math, just because, well, right now anyway, in particle physics, there have been advances, but they're so esoteric, it's very difficult for the layman to understand what they mean. Whereas, you know, when we built a rocket, I mean, everybody could understand what that meant. Hey, we can go to the stars, we can go to the moon. So it inspired a whole lot of people in a way that, you know, finding Higgs boson or whatever has not really inspired.
I still don't know what that means. Just like, congrats. Good job, guys. I'm real proud of you for sticking at it.
I had to be on this panel last year at Mile High Con where it was about neutrinos and Higgs bosons and whatever. And I was like, oh man, I'm an engineer, not a particle physicist. You know, I had to like call up my friends from Caltech and be like, so can you tell me about the latest advances and, you know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, people, it's hard to understand and it's hard for people to get inspired by it, but that doesn't mean that there's not something coming that will inspire people in a new way. I always liked them. Did you read Peter Hamilton, who writes pretty accessible space opera verging on, I wouldn't call it hard science fiction, but, you know, it's definitely got the...
I have not, because I have a rule about I have a rule about books by dudes.
Yeah.
Where if I can put their book in a pillowcase and twist it up and use it as a weapon, I'm not reading it. because I feel like that's a lot of effort when I'm trying to, like, fix my gender parity from, like, the early, late 1990s and early 2000s, where I was reading nothing but men, like, where I didn't, where there was, like, a year in there, like, 2003, where I read, like, 57 books and all of them were by men, so.
No, well, I definitely think you should read Citeen before you get anywhere near Peter Hamilton.
So,
but,
no, that's on my list. I know, you're never going to give up. You're going to be like, hey,
I know.
Have you read that yet? How's it going?
Until you read that, especially because you like Ancillary Justice, and I think that there's a lot of really interesting comparisons to be made between C.J. Cherry's treatment of identity and basically cultural and personal identity versus what Anne Leckie does in Ancillary Justice. But anyway, jumping back to Peter Hamilton for a minute, even if you don't read his books, the point is that in Pandora's Star, and this isn't a spoiler because the book like opens with this, this like the landing of the first manned mission to Mars, and you know the point of view character is the leader of the mission and they're landing in the spacecraft and they get out and they're taking their first historic steps. And then this wormhole opens and it's two like stone grad students from like, you know, San Francisco being like, whoa, hey guys, you know, whatever. And so it completely shifts all of, you know, our space travel efforts and everything because these two guys made this leap about how to use wormholes or whatever. And I thought that was a really great example of how technology actually works, you know, or how physical discoveries actually work, that you think it's going to be one thing, you think you're going to do this, and then all of a sudden, you know, somebody comes along with something that just completely throws everything onto a new path. And so when that happens, if somebody invents wormhole travel, if somebody does that kind of thing, then yeah, I think we'll see a humongous renaissance in the, you know, the classic style of hard science fiction that focuses on what that type of technological advancement will mean. So there's my thing about about hard science fiction. But going back to your thing about reading all men, yeah, it's so funny to see people talk about this gender divide because I didn't even know there was one before I got published because I don't know, I guess I lucked out with my libraries and stuff. I've read thousands and thousands of books, right? I used to read like a book a day. Yeah, I literally would go through my library and I would read every single science fiction book on their shelves. And I bought all the ones that I liked best. That was my rule. I only bought a book if I loved it. Everything else I got from the library. Yeah, about 70% of the science fiction and fantasy on my shelves here at home are by women. And I didn't even try. Like, it was just, those were the books that I happened to like. Now, granted, I suspect, you know, thinking about that now, I'm like, I think it's because I read so much. And so what I wasn't depending on people to recommend to me. I just literally, like I said, would go down the stacks and read every single book that I came across. And so I read all these awesome women that were out there, and I had no idea that other people weren't. And so that makes me really sad, actually, to look back and think, you know, there are these women who have been and still are writing all these great, great books, and apparently people haven't read them. And I'm like, no, you guys, you don't understand. There were so many excellent books that I read as a kid that just and still read now that just cemented my love of the genre. And yeah, there were guys, but yeah, there are tons of women too, and they always have been writing science fiction and fantasy. It's not a new thing. So
I grew up in Arkansas and in the South, and I had a town. It was a town of 630 people. We had one public library. It was the size of I wish I could like explain the scope of the size of this library. Like, if you ever been in it, the gas station in town was bigger than the public library, the inside. And, like, there were more candy choices at the local gas station than there were science fiction and fantasy choices. I remember Piers Anthony on the shelf. I remember there was a lot of Star Wars time novels, and I wasn't into Star Wars. It's a blast. Sometimes people get upset at me when I tell them I didn't watch Star Wars until I was in college. I didn't really do a lot of older visual science fiction. I was more into the aesthetic of the future looking science fiction. It would take me a while to come around to appreciate what the older visual stuff was doing. But like, so Piers Anthony's, a lot of time novels, there's Stephen King, Robert Jordan was there. But like, as far as women went, they had Anne McCaffrey, but they were all, like, the men would be, they would have series, right? But they would the whole series would be there, that what was out. And then you would have women, and it'd be like the second book and the fifth book, and like, it would be all messed up. The romance section of my library was huge. So that's where I ended up. My high school library is where I found Speaker for the Dead, which would have opened up the doors for me a little. mm-hmm. and then my librarian who helped me find the Hugo Award, which opened it up even more. But then I couldn't get a hold of these books that were on these lists because I lived in the place. Like, I would go to the Searcy, which was the nearest town, and I would go to these bookstores and I would tell them about these lists, and they're like, well, we don't have that here. And they wouldn't even offer to order it for me. And then I remember one day, it was like a little independent shop, and I went in and this guy was there, and I asked him if he had any of the books on like the 1983 Hugo shortlist, because that's the year I was born, and I'm a nerd, so that's why I was just like, I'll read the books that came out the year I was born, that'll be interesting. And like he was like, well, I don't think you'd be interested in any of these. And then he gave me a Daniel Steele novel.
Oh man.
I'm really glad to hear that, like, that I'm apparently in a minority, because a lot of other people, like, grew up reading women in science fiction and fantasy, but I just sort of missed out. And I know that the gender divide exists in really weird ways. Like, I'm doing the coverage of women on SF blogs again for next year. I'm compiling 2013 right now. Mm-hmm. And my thesis always is, like, if you're a woman, you're gonna be reading more women because you're socialized to identify with men and women. And if you're a man, you're gonna probably be reading more men because you're not socialized to empathize with women. That's just kind of like science. Like, there's a book about it that I'm reading right now called Delusions of Gender by Cordelia Fine that pretty much proves our thesis. And I'm compiling these lists, and my thesis is like already being proven again. And confirmation bias is a thing because I've been watching the community for like the last year, going, oh, it's really getting much better. People are talking. People are thinking more deeply about this issue. And now I'm looking at the numbers, and they're not bearing out what I'm seeing. It's a complicated issue. It's hard to talk about, I think, because there's so many different intersecting issues.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. And I have to say, like, listening to, you know, you talk about your library, it makes me want to hunt down the librarian for the Reston, Virginia library from where I grew up and, like, I don't know, send them, like, a enormous fruit basket or something, you know, or, like, a check or something like that, because they obviously did such a good job making sure that there was a wide variety of science fiction titles and, you know, everything. As a kid, I was such a snob. I wouldn't read anything mainstream. It had to be science fiction or fantasy, or I wouldn't touch it. Or horror. I guess I would read horror too. But anyway, my point being that there was enough in my library to keep me busy for all those years. And so I'm really grateful to those librarians for making sure that the collection was varied and, you know, had all the books like in order and whatever. Although I think we've talked about this on Twitter before. I did learn to read series out of order.
I have a visceral reaction to even thinking about doing it. I'm like, nope. I just noped out of there. I mean, I'm really glad that people can. I have lots of friends who do it. But I just want to be like, how does your brain... I would get so confused. But that's because I'm bad at, like, patterns. Like, name recognition. I have apparently a block. Like, when I read, I take notes. And I don't know anybody else who takes notes when they read fiction. I'm a complicated reader.
Yeah, although I think it's a skill that you build up. You know what I mean? Like, I think probably the first time I read a book out of order, I was like, what the... You know? But I think, well, especially as a kid, I think maybe you're a little bit more willing to be like, well, it'll make sense at some time because, you know, I mean, so many things don't make sense when you're a kid, right?
Right.
And so you kind of learn to be like, well, I'm just going to keep going and at some point it'll make sense. And if it doesn't, well, I'll track down the first book sometime. And, you know, I don't know. So I learned that pretty young, I guess. And it has been helpful. Although I understand, I don't do that now. I don't read series out of order anymore now that I guess thanks to having a good day job or whatever, I can always just buy the first book if it's not there in the library. Although, like I said, until I started reading books electronically, I did not buy a book unless I had read it before and loved it, or it was one of the few authors that I had on my auto buy list. But now, with the Kindle, I'm just like, oh, it's so easy, buy.
That's how you end up with 135 books. And in like 2 weeks, that's not good.
I know my bank account is sad for it, but yeah, my husband got me the Kindle for Christmas a couple years ago because he was like, our house is going to collapse under the weight of the books that you have. And these are only the ones that you love. And you say that you can't possibly get rid of any of them. And, you know, and so, yes, thanks. Thankfully, since then, I have reduced my paper. Although I actually, if I really love a book and I read it in ebook form, I still buy it in paper because as an engineer, I know too well not to depend on the format still being readable in like 10 years or whatever. Right. Electronic does not mean permanent.
No, it's
it just
true.
Means convenient. I do still buy in paper, but only
speaking
when I really
of buying.
Like it.
So you mentioned an Autobot list, and now I'm intrigued yeah. to know who is on your Autobot list.
Well, let me see. I'm sitting here in the office. I'm going to turn around so that I can see my shelves. So CJ Cherry was one, although, you know, I know that you're about to or hoping to read Forner, and I have a confession to make. I'm like, of all of I have read everything that CJ Cherry has written, except for all of her Forner series, because after about the second or third book, I just bounced off. I can't even explain it. It's not that the right, you know, many people love her entire Forner series, and I like the books. I don't know. After something around the third book, I think I don't like Bren, the main character, quite enough or something. But anyway, but that said, anything that she writes that's not Forner is on my Autobuy list. Who else? Martha Wells, Carol Berg. What else? Well, it used to be Robin Hobb, although I had a little – trouble is the wrong word. But I guess her recent series have been a little bit bleak for me. I really liked her first couple series. Like I said, it's just the last couple. She has a style of writing that it's kind of like this slow motion emotional train wreck.
So it's like being a fandom. I get enough of that for fandom. I don't need to do that in original work. I need some happiness.
That said, she's writing a new series that is gonna, I think, at least take place in the world many of them take place in the same world, but I think it's going to be featuring some of the characters like Fitz and the Fool from her original series that I just love those books. So I will be right there when that one releases. But I'm trying to think, Emma Bull, anything Emma Bull ever writes, I am there. And Barbara Hambly. Although right these days she's writing mostly historical mysteries, and I have to admit I'm not like a huge historical mystery person, so I haven't read her historical mystery series, but anything she writes in the science fiction and fantasy genre I've always bought. And I don't know. I mean, there's a bunch. I could keep going. Yeah, so many women who write so many awesome books, and men too. I mean, but it does just so happen, and I've thought about this as part of the gender divide thing. I had not realized it about myself until I went and looked at my own shelves. I was like, gosh, all these books that I really, really love are by women. And that's not, I mean, I let's see, I like David Brin's early novels a lot, you know, science fiction, and Guy Gabriel Kay, I love.
Oh,
and,
God, no. Ira shipped me some of his books. She shipped me The Lines of Al-Razan, Tagana, and A Song for Arbon, I think is what it's called. So she shipped me those three books, and I read Tagana, and I had a nervous breakdown. It was the most soul-crushing book. I was already really bad at it. I was bad at epic fantasy. Like, I still have notes from when I read Tagana. Like, I filled up half of like a 100-page notebook with notes. So it was a hard book for me to get through anyway. And then it just punches you in the soul. It was just...
Well, you know, I like soul punching.
And then she was like, well, The Lines is worse. I'm like, no, no, I refuse. So I still haven't read it. Eventually I will, but I don't know. Like, I get enough of that. I get enough emotional abuse from Supernatural at this point. I'll have to wait until Supernatural finishes until I can read more Guy Gabriel Kay. Sorry, dude.
Yeah, well, A Song for Arbonne is my favorite of his, I think. Patricia McKillop, I buy everything by her. And Diana Wynne Jones when she was still alive. I've got a fair amount.
You've got a fairly large to-buy list. I'm really glad that you have a well-paying job, because, oh my goodness.
And that's a problem these days. I see a book, I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. Oh, bye, you know. The only thing that keeps me my bank account safe is that when I'm writing, I just don't have as much time to read as I did before and parenting. So I have to kind of keep control.
To go back to an earlier topic about conventions, as you know, I don't go to conventions because I'm poor. So I'll have to live vicariously through everybody else who gets to go to conventions. And you go to like several, right? You got like, you went to WorldCon this year. There was another one, then she just went to Mile High Con. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the local one here.
And so you're going to all these conventions. Like, okay, so you have to explain conventions to me because I've never gone to one.
You know, I'm not a great person for it, actually, because I had not gone to very many before. Well, actually, no, let me amend that. I had been to zero written word focused conventions before I became an author. I had been to like what do you call it, Starfest or something here once or twice. It's like a media con, you know what I mean? This is back in the days when, like, I was totally into Babylon 5, and, you know, they had, like, Babylon 5 actors come and talk, and I would go watch and whatever. But anyway, the written conventions, I mean, honestly, I go to them these days it's like a cool place to hang out with people, you know, to meet either author friends or people who aren't authors but are just, you know, cool too, like I like talking about books. I mean, I always love talking about books, so that's a perfect place to do it. I actually don't often go to that much programming, which, you know, is terrible given the amount of money that you're usually paying to go. Like something like Mile High Con, that's local to where I'm on programming or whatever, they often comp you the rate. So it doesn't cost anything if you're on programming. But Worldcon, you know, pretty much everybody pays, except for the guest
spot. And pays.
Yeah. But World Fantasy, like all my critique group have been going to World Fantasy for like, I don't know, you know, 18 years or something like this. And so first I was kind of like, I don't know. I heard that one is mostly for, because this is before, I think, was it before I had the book deal? Well, anyway. Point being, I was like, well, I don't know. I heard that one's mostly for veterans and, you know, and they were like, no, it's really interesting. There's all sorts of interesting people. And yeah, that one's totally a let's all hang out in the bar and talk sort of convention. There is programming, but I don't know. It's almost like beside the point. But yeah, I've had so much fun at them. But again, it's just because it's a place to go and meet people that you share an interest with. I'm an introvert. And so having something to readily talk about is always nice, you know. If you're at the science fiction convention, you're pretty much guaranteed that the other people there are going to like some form of science fiction or fantasy. So you always have something to talk about. And there are just really interesting people that go. I just have all kinds of interesting conversations. So I think there is often interesting programming and all that kind of stuff too. But as you've probably seen on Twitter, there's been all the blah over programming recently, you know, whether it's gender parity on panels or are we talking enough about new stuff and not old stuff and whatever. I don't know. I just kind of go, whatever with those. Cause to me, the convention is about, well, let's just go and spend time with awesome people. I don't care as much about the programming, I guess.
You hosted a party or your publisher hosted a party at World?
No, that would be, us, not the publisher.
I didn't know. I couldn't tell. It's really complicated.
We started doing that back when I was running the Night Bazaar blog, which that was back in 2011 when my book was released. I had the idea. I don't know if you ever heard of the Debutante Ball blog, which is a blog for female authors who are like in their having their debut book come out that year. And I thought, well, man, that's a really fun sounding way to meet other people whose books are coming out and everything. And at the time when I got my book deal, it was too late to apply to be one of the people for the next year. So I thought, well, hey, I'll start my own that's science fiction and fantasy focused. And so originally it wasn't going to be like just Nightshade people. I was going to ask whoever, but it just turned out it was easier to find people from my own publisher, you know, that I knew that were going to have debuts coming out. At that time, I didn't realize that you could, I don't know, look at catalogs and stuff and from other publishers and figure it out. So ended up being a gang of us from Nightshade, all of us who were debuting in 2011. And we did this blog, you know, for a year where we were all posting once a week, every week, talking about different topics and stuff. And anyway, as part of that, we were like, well, hey, let's, you know, a bunch of us are going to Worldcon. Let's have a party. And we did. And yeah, it was really fun. it's been continuously like my favorite part of like the Worldcon thing, because not only do I get to see people that I organize with, which are, you know, the other authors and whatever, but also the people who come to the party. I mean, you get everybody from other authors to fans to bloggers to whatever. And so just, again, concentration of cool people with something already on the table to talk about. So, we did, let's see, we did 2 years of that as like a Night Bazaar thing. And then after that, some of us like Teresa and Maz and I had wanted to start a new little collective that wasn't focused on Nightshade. So we started booksworn.com, which is a bunch of us kind of newer authors that aren't just Nightshade. There's other people in there. And so a bunch of us plus some other friends hosted a party at this year's WorldCon, which was worthy. Justin ate that bug for you.
I know. It was really nice of him, wasn't it?
Yeah, but you should have seen that thing.
No, huge. I did, because there were photos taken and sent to me going, you should.
I think the photo did not fully capture.
No, I was just like, I can't believe he's doing this for fanfic, which he doesn't even like. He doesn't even like fanfic. He's just like, He told me that, like, we were talking about fanfic the other day. He's like, I just don't see the appeal. I'm like, no, I understand. No, that makes sense. But I'm just like, why did you eat this horrible thing just to get me fanfic? I'm sure she would have done it without it. I could have just bribed her with something else.
Oh, it was hilarious. You should have seen the look on his face when it was, like, going down his throat. But, but yeah, no, the bug thing actually came about because back at the first party, you know, we were like, well, how can we be like, you know, have like a theme to our party? Oh, Night Bazaar. Okay. Like Oriental Bazaar. I don't know. You know, I don't know. We wanted to have like wild and crazy stuff or something. And Katie Stauber, who's from Texas, she said, well, I'll go get a bunch of stuff from like the market downtown. And so she showed up and she had all these, yeah, these like edible bugs, which these were pretty friendly bugs. These were like sour cream and onion flavored little worms and crickets and things. I mean, they were so heavily flavored, like the powder, that was all you could taste. But anyway, seems like each year since then, she's upped her game a little. And so this year she like imported them direct from Thailand. And we like get in there and we like open these packets and we're just like, oh my God, you know, these things like don't have any flavor on them. They're just like enormous and ugly. Whatever. You're like, oh man, are people actually going to eat these things? I don't know.
Yes. But then, they are.
Yes. Yes, they would. People would do just about anything for a free book. Yeah, we had decided because we had like one copy of Elspeth Cooper's The Raven Shadow. It was the only copy on U.S. soil. She'd shipped it over to us from the U.K. Or actually her publisher did, or I don't know, something. Anyway, we had this copy and we're like, oh man, well, if we only have one of these, we better ask somebody to eat one of the really nasty ones, because we had like these scorpions that were about as big as your palm or something. And so we're like, okay, boy, it's going to take a tough person to eat one of these. And like the second person into the party is like Josh Voigt. And we're like, oh, you got to eat a scorpion for this book. He's like, all right, give it to me. Chomp, you know. We're like, all right, here's the book. I guess we should have, you know, I don't know, said we, like, you had to eat one of every bug or, you know, something. So
lesson learned for next time.
I know. But it's actually, you know, the fun thing about it is just that when you're running the party, this is something we learned the first time. Originally, we were going to have like, I don't know, trivia stuff or I don't know, some other way to give away the books, but we discovered that it's really annoying in a party to have to stop everybody's conversations and hold some kind of giveaway. And so that's when Katie had hit upon the idea of, well, we've got these bugs sitting here, why don't we tell people that if they eat one of them, they can get a free book. All they have to do is eat it in front of us, you know, one of us that's hosting, because we had, you know, we usually have like 8 to 13 people who are hosting. So yeah, that worked great, because then nobody has to stop their conversations and people can pick the book they really want and eat a bug for it. And, you know, everyone is entertained. And when they go out of the party to other parties, they're like, oh my God, you guys, there's this party where people are eating bugs. You have to see it to believe it. And yeah, our parties are always packed because people want to see the bug eating, even if they don't want to participate in it themselves. So
listen, I'll just buy the book. I'll just buy it.
Well, I remember the first, no, was it the first party or the second party? There was this lady who came up and she was like, so I really want your book, but I really don't want to have to eat a bug. And so I totally gave it to her. I think I put something in the description, like, next time I'll make you eat the bug or whatever. But, you know, I mean, if somebody really wants my book, I'm not going to.
You're not going to force them to be like, here, eat this disgusting object. Put this in your body.
I know. Now, Justin, he had to eat that bug. I'm sorry.
Oh, gosh. Like, I'll never repay. Like, I'm going to owe him for, like, until 2023 for, like, favors, because he did that for me. I'm really glad he did that for me, because it's really cool. Like, I got a book and it's signed and I got some fanfic, which is super awesome, by the way.
It was fun. I had fun writing it. It was, yeah, it was a good way to get kind of unstuck from something that I was stuck on. So so really, I should be thanking you.
No, it's super fun. But speaking of fanfic, I don't think you're in fandom like I'm in fandom. Like, I don't know if you are. Like, some people have, like, other identities where they take part in fandom and then they have, like, their published identity where they pretend they're not involved at all because it still has, like, certain stigma attached to it.
No, I always was the consummate lurker.
Always.
In fandom. I believe the only fandom I ever really sort of participated in was Forever Night, way
wow.
Back in the day.
My
very first one. Yeah, on like the Forknye.L mailing list.
Wow, the mailing list.
I believe I posted occasionally to that, and then they used to run these what do they call them? Forever Night Wars or whatever. It was like this whole like fanfic thing where like people would get into groups based on the character that they liked best, and they would have like, you know, basically write fic at each other, like kind of, I don't know, pretending to have this little war or whatever. And one of my best friend, who was also in the fandom with me, ended up being one of the organizers, I think, one year for the people who were fans of Nick, you know, the main character. Mm-hmm. And so I think I wrote a couple little things for that or whatever, but that is literally my only time ever. Other than that, I was the lurker extraordinaire. I read everybody's posts, read all the fic, and never ever participated. Yeah. Which means I probably missed out on a lot of fun, but on the other hand, I guess I spent a lot of that time reading instead, so I can't say. I don't know what would have been better, to participate or not to participate. But
no, lurkers, we need lurkers. Like, back when Strike Through happened, I don't know if you know what that is, on LJ, where they deleted all those communities because of that that little group that was like trying to shut down shop porn or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they like deleted the tons of communities that were fanish because of their interests or whatever. And people started locking stuff down. They would move their stuff or they would lock their fic down. And I got really upset because a lot of the people in my fandom at the time started to lock their stuff down. I mean, I understand why they were doing it, and it was their stuff it was their work to do that with. But it's also like the lurker culture in fandom, and especially in the fandoms that I was in, it was extremely high. There was not a lot of like outright participation, but I would check my like stats, and the hits would be through the roof because there were all these lurkers there that weren't talking. So I was just like, if we lock this down, we're cutting our community in half. And this is why I'm like not big on like password gates or making people join communities to read fic or having like gates in front of stuff, because for me and a lot of fandoms too, I was a lurker, and when that would happen, I would just be locked out because I wasn't gonna like send somebody a PM to be like, hey, will you add me to your community so I can read your fic? I was never gonna do that. I'm really sensitive to lurker behavior and making sure it's accessible for lurkers, because they oftentimes are the biggest like readers of
the silent majority of fandom.
So.
Well, hooray for you. Like, I know that was one thing that always kind of, I wouldn't say frustrated me about fake, but, you know, I would kind of make a list of, I would keep notes of, like, all the ones that I liked or whatever so I could go back and reread them. And, you know, it's such an ever-changing thing, right? You go back, like, I don't know, not even a week later and the fic would be gone or locked or whatever, you know. And I know some people, I guess, would do the thing where they would copy the whole fic onto their hard drive so that they could read it at their leisure and not have that happen, but I read really fast. I just never could have done that. My hard drive would be totally full, and B, it just would be too much effort. So yeah, you know, I would always be like, oh man, I really like that person's stuff, and now I can't read it anymore. Oh well, you know, and then mm-hmm. and go on. And it was always a little bit sad. But like you say, I understand why people do it. And
no, I'm really happy that the AO3 has their option where you can download stuff. Like I mm-hmm. I went through specifically when they debuted that option and like downloaded like any fic that I had bookmarked over like the past, like if it was on AO3 and it was on my favorites list, I downloaded it and I have it on the USB drive. And I've had to expand since then. I have like several different USB drives for like fandoms at this point. Even though we have talked about how electronic doesn't mean forever, for right now I'm comforted. I have this file. It'll be okay.
Well, it's certainly more forever than, you know, sitting out there on the internet somewhere.
I tried to suck you into fandom. It just says, you're like, I had to write this book. I'm like, let me write the book and then come hang out over here.
Well, you know what I need is just another show that I loved as much as I loved the first seasons of Supernatural. Because that was what always got me to do it, right? Was that I would watch some, like, for me, fic works best for TV shows because TV shows don't have the time often to fill in all the emotional blanks. And so that's what fic does for you, is fills in the spaces that the TV show does not have the time or the inclination to fill in. So yeah, it would be me hooked on a TV show and going and reading all this fic to get more of those characters and fill in the spaces that the TV show wasn't doing for me. But I guess, I don't know, I haven't found anything,
you
know, in these
back.
Last years.
I want you to come back to Supernatural. I just want you to come back. It's fine. It's only a little painful, and by a little, I mean 18 tons of pain and suffering.
You know what I was thinking about it after I think we talked about it on Twitter, like what made me stop or what made me lose, you know, the drive to keep going or whatever. And, you know, I was always a Sam girl, and I did not like what they ended up doing with his character, at least to the point that I finished watching or stopped watching.
I don't remember where you stopped. Where did you stop?
Oh, I want to say like the end of season 6 or something. Well, basically, it's where I stopped was where it ends with, you know, they've kind of taken care of the whole Lucifer plotline thing, you know, where Lucifer was trying to come back as Sam, and it ends, you know, where Sam has gone to hell or whatever, and it ends, I think the season ends with like Dean is with the girl that he liked or something, and Sam is like lurking outside or something. Right. Anyway, but yeah, I had just, it was one of those things where I think this only happens when you really love something a lot, where you can get really, you get so set on the idea of the characters you're hoping that they're going to be, right? Or, mm-hmm. or what the writers are going to do, that when they do something different, that it gets too frustrating. And now thinking as an author, like I was thinking about this in terms of authorhood, like in terms of series, I'm sure it happens with book series too, with people, you know, where you're like, but that so wasn't what I wanted to happen, you know?
Right, no, but this is why they make fanfic. This is why this exists.
Yeah. So for me, you know, I really liked what they did with the characters in the first couple seasons. And then throughout the, I want to say like the last two that I watched, I'd been getting more and more, I think what bothered me was that it's okay to me if a character is portrayed in a unsympathetic light if I believe that we are supposed to be seeing them as unsympathetic. But what bothers me is when I feel the character is being portrayed in an unsympathetic light, but the creator of the show does not see it as unsympathetic. Do you know what I mean?
No. Now I want you to come back, because see, they're on season 9. We've cycled around to season 1 again, season 1 dynamic. So see, eventually we get back. So you need to finish your book so I can like suck you into this fan with me.
Well, you know, I'd be willing to give another shot. I'd have to talk my husband into it. But,
Listen, he doesn't. We don't need to. We can just be keep it on the down low. He doesn't got to be involved. We gotta tell him.
Well, you know, it's just that
it's a little hard. It's like hiding an addiction. Yeah. No, I'm fine. It's just stuff your DVDs under the table so they can't see them.
Well, you know, and there's been things that he's watched that I haven't. Like, I mean, he was really into. All the various Stargates. Like, I liked Stargate Atlantis, although actually that's a funny one. Speaking of fic, I actually got into that show because all the people that wrote the fic that I liked for Smallville started writing SGA fic. And I had been like, but I don't really care that much about Stargate SG-1. Oh, man, everybody's going to this fandom and it's Stargate. And, I mean, I didn't hate Stargate or whatever, but I don't know, I wasn't hooked on it. But then I started reading their fic and I was like, oh. I actually got hooked on the fic rather than the show. And then I started watching the show so I could like better understand the fic. And I always did. I have to admit, I liked the show better than I liked SG-1, but I always liked the fic better than the show.
No, the thing about Stargate Atlantis is that the writers, all they did was like lay out like a baseline for fic writers to surpass them at every point. That's all. That's all Stargate Atlantis was like an open world where you could come in and you could be like, oh, writer, that was a good try, but I'm going to do something better.
Is it Stargate Atlantis was perfect for fic, like you say, because they always played it safe on the show. They never were willing to really, they were willing to do a little bit more at first, but they never really were willing to take serious risks with the characters. They always had to make sure that everything kind of went back to the same way it was. And so I find that frustrating as a viewer of a TV show, because I prefer shows where the characters actually grow and change. I mean, that's one reason I liked Farscape so much, was because I don't think I've ever seen a show that did it better in terms of over the 4 seasons, that the character goes through so much change, believable change. Anyway, but yeah, SGA, they always played it safe, but the fic writers didn't, and so that's why I liked reading the fic so much.
I was in that, like, I wrote one thing in that fandom, and at that time I was in Final Fantasy, where, like, if you wrote a story and posted it, you would get, like, maybe 3 comments. I was always in small fandoms. I wasn't, Inception was, like, my first, like, super big fandom where I got, like, a lot of people who read my stuff. But I wrote one story, and it was just, like, something that I wrote at, like, 3 a.m. I'm like, this is an interesting idea, and I want to be experimental. And I wrote this thing, and I posted it up, and, like, I woke up the next morning, and I had 25 comments. I'm like, who the hell are these people? Where are they coming from? I was a little flabbergasted. That fandom was, like, so. Then I became became a super lurker in that fandom and never posted anything again. Because I'm like, there's too many people, too much tension, can't handle it. I got a little better. The fandom was just so, like... I can't think of a good word to describe the fandom. It was like they were just really excited and enthusiastic and creative with what they were doing, and they really, really cared about the implications of the world. I had never done TV fandoms really. I think that was probably my first mainstream TV fandom that I was in, and it just really changed my perspective on people who were like into TV and how they would, like, engage individually with episodes and character arcs over hours and hours and hours of like, show, it was a really kind of a transformative experience to go into a fandom where, like, because all Final Fantasy games were obviously close canon, unless they have sequels, but, like, Final Fantasy, the ones I was in, like, Final Fantasy 8 and Final Fantasy 10 and 10-2, like, they, like, you had an 80-hour game and then it ended, so we didn't have more canon coming in. So when you're in a fandom that is still active and there's still canon being made, it changes the dynamic a lot. I love Stargate Atlantis fandom, like, it's still one of my favorite fandoms, but I'm just like, guys, you're super excited, and I'm a little scared.
Well, I think, you know, that's part of what drew me to the TV show fandom thing, because I always liked watching episodes of stuff and then discussing them afterward with friends. That was kind of the draw for me, is like, hey, if I'm watching it in real time, then all these people are discussing the episode and making theories and speculating and all this, and I always found that really fun. And so that was as much part of it for me as the fic. Again, I didn't participate. I just would sit there and read, like, every single thread on Television Without Pity or, you know, wherever, mailing lists and goodness knows what else, forums, about whatever it was that I was interested in. And I would save all my actual speculation and stuff for, you know, my friends in real life, I guess, that we would get together and watch the show. But yeah, just having that kind of, that ongoing thing. And actually, I was thinking about it just now. I was like, yeah, that's probably why I haven't been in fandom recently, is because since my son was born, he's 4 years old now, but we don't watch TV in real time, you know, like as it's airing. We just get everything off Netflix, which means that we wait a year. And so everybody has long since discussed those episodes and speculated and whatever, you know, so I don't know. It's taken some of the fun out of it. Obviously, as my son gets older, I might be able to go back to watching live TV again. But honestly, right now, it's just like,
finish your book, you know, first.
I need to read the book.
I'm in pain.
My priorities are kind of like, you know, parenthood and day job and book and then hiking and skiing and climbing and whatever. And then TV watching is somewhere down there at the bottom. I mean, reading is higher, much, much higher than TV watching, because I can't not read. It would be like not breathing. I do read a lot of YA and nonfiction and stuff while I'm in heavy work mode on a book, because I can, well, with YA, I can finish it quickly. I can read it in like an hour. But
what?
Well, I'm a fast reader.
Apparently so. That's kind of speedy. Jesus Christ.
Now, I told you, before parenthood and everything, I would read a book a day. And, you know, a serious book, an adult book. I mean, not to say that YA is not serious, but you know what I mean.
I'll even be like, so you're letting people say that YA isn't serious now.
I know.
Like,
no, that's not what I meant. No, all I mean is that, you know, YA does tend to be shorter than adult. Not always, but a lot of the time. So I can breeze through it pretty quickly and enjoy the book and then still have like an hour of writing time. Nonfiction I can also do, because I can put it down. I can like read something and then like stop and then read another chapter later and stop. I have a lot of trouble doing that with a fiction book.
I'm going to open this book and read one chapter. I can totally put it down later, and then 7 hours later, you're like, I'm done. I'm like, Jesus Christ. What? Go to bed.
I know. Well, and obviously, since now my scant free time after my son goes to bed has to be mostly devoted to writing. That's why I don't read nearly so much anymore, unfortunately. It's the saddest part to me about being an author. Although, actually, what really freaked me out about being an author is when I realized that everybody else reads even less than I do. Like, you know how the Nebula Awards are voted on by the members of SFWA?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I used to think, oh, well, hey, that's kind of like, I mean, you know, that's people who should know what they're doing because they're authors and whatever. And then I became an author and I realized that nobody reads a damn thing.
What are the criteria?
Busy writing their own books. So, yeah, how is that working? I still don't quite get it.
Maybe they have, like, secrets. Maybe, like, maybe when they induct you to the SFWA, they tell, like, this is a secret. Here's your time, Turner.
No, I don't know. I'm an SFWA member. Nobody's giving me my time.
How long have you been a member?
So
maybe it's like you have to graduate into. Maybe you only get it after 5 years. Like, so, oh, you're going to stick. Okay, here you go.
Yeah. Well, I do think, you know, I like that the Nebulas do tend to sometimes kind of single out books that are less mainstream, which is nice. And that's because, you know, authors, we meet each other and I guess we hear about books maybe sometimes that the general reading public doesn't have as much of a chance to hear about. So you might hear your author friend be like, oh my gosh, this book is awesome, you know, and you read it. And even though it wasn't, it didn't sell very many in stores or whatever, you still get to read it and think it's awesome. So I think that there's some of that going on in the Nebulas, that there is an ability to find out about books that are not as popular or mainstream.
I got some questions for you when I like advertised on Twitter, like, I'm going to interview her. You should send me some questions. And people send me some questions. Well, one person submits some questions, and then another question. So it works person. Out. We have one enough time. Awesome.
I should go hug them, whoever they are.
My question is obviously because I am big on finding new things in the community to follow and learn from. Is I would like to know your favorite genre sources, like blogs and places you follow online for news.
I would have to say that, I mean, I use Twitter a lot, you know, just because you see people posting about their blog posts about books or whatever, right? And so often I'll click on those. But anyway, let's see, blogs that I follow. I guess, let's see, Fantasy Book Critic and Justin's blog, you know, Staffer's Review.
If you didn't follow Justin's blog, he would come track you down and
no, he would come
handcuff you to his blog. He'd be like, too bad, you're strapped.
Well, see, I owe Justin because he was the very, very first review I ever got of Whitefire. ever. Oh, my goodness. I remember I was, like, on Twitter, and I think he tweeted at me, you know, or whatever, mm-hmm. or I can't remember if he tweeted at me. Yeah, I think he did. And he was like, oh, I'm reading this and it's really good so far. And I think I'll have a review up in a day or two. And, oh, you don't even want to know how, like, I couldn't even sleep the next night.
Like, yeah, he's where I found out about your book.
Oh, really? Yeah, awesome. Well, anyway, so yes, I obviously have to follow Justin's blog for all time. Let's see, Stefan Reitz, I guess how you say his name, Far Beyond Reality. Bibliotropic. Bookworm Blues. I just recently started doing Book Smugglers, I think. They review such a nice range of books. I really like that. And what else? But, you know, honestly, I mean, I read through a lot of people's blogs and whatever, but I don't I get to the posts by either seeing them say something on Twitter or on forums like either, let's see, SFF World or Westeros.org.
So weird, or the forums are still a thing. Like, it feels like to me forum culture ended like 6 years ago, but they're still around apparently. So
I know some of us are still reading anyway. But the point is, like, a lot of people, like, I think, what is it, Ken Nethspace or Adam Whitehead, Worthead. Wort Zone, that's what I'm thinking of, his blog. Anyway, when they do a review, they post links to all of those forums or whatever, so I can't possibly miss it. So if I'm looking at one, I'll see it there, and so I'll go and I'll look and read the review and kind of pick up on books that way. But I also just find out a lot through recommendations from friends, and those could come on Twitter, they could come in email or whatever. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of a vague and rambling list, but...
No, I like that list. I'm one of these that's one of I'm going to find people I don't know, but I follow everybody.
Somebody really important. Fantasy Book Cafe. I really like her reviews, and I had been reading her book for her blog for a long time.
List. It's going to be terrible. She's like, I think she stopped speaking to me because, like, I've owned her during her Women in SF Month. We compiled that list of female authors and books, and we were supposed to be up in June, and then I realized that everybody had, like, used different titles and different author names, and, like, this list had to be, like, curated and fixed. And I didn't ask for ISBN numbers. Like, I'm like a logical person would have done. I'm just like, just give me the book and the author name, that'll be fine. It wasn't fine. It was a terrible decision. So I've spent, like, it's still not done. I mean, we're still coding it now. We're in the coding process. Like, the curation is done, like, the fixing. And poor Kristen had to go through this list and fix all these author names and point out, like, duplicates and be like, and this is a man and a woman. Do we want that? And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, I did not think this through. So I'm like, she's like, I just have this feeling. She's like over there going, oh, I'm never doing a project with you again. You're such a slacker. But she's fantastic.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to see the list whenever it should come out.
It's long. We got around 200, I want to say, like, between 250 and 300 submissions, but that was like 10 submissions, like 10 pieces of data per submission.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I broke Google Docs trying to put the list, like, put it in a spreadsheet. I broke Google Docs. I broke it.
That's always a great feeling.
Like, every time I opened the spreadsheet, it would crash. So I had to, like, export it out and take it to, like, I had to go find a copy of Excel so I could put it in Excel to fix it. It's like, oh my goodness, I didn't. So, no, it'll be up one day, and then we'll have this list brought to you about hours and hours and hours of Renee's life.
Well, I'll have to appreciate it extra well then.
You're on the list, congratulations.
Oh, am I? Yeah, oh, nice. Oh, yeah, and I was also going to say, I mean, there's people who also are kind of independent reviewers that I pay attention to their reviews, like Paul Prince Justin. He reviews for SF Signal and Functional Nerds, and I think sometimes he does reviews on his own blog as well. But anyway, I pay attention to his, and there's a couple other people who are like that who don't have their own, or they might have their own blogs, but they tend to write reviews for the bigger sites. And I pay attention to them also. So really it's just this big kind of gestalt of everybody that I see on my Twitter feed and blogs and hearing friends talk about books and everything that I get all my recommendations from.
So the four questions that came from Robin, she has like four, so I reorganized them and I'll ask you in order. The first question is, it was interesting to read a fantasy series that has lots of adventure but no swords or armies or wars or even very many fights. Did you deliberately set out to write books without much violence, or did the story just develop that way?
Interesting. you know, I have to laugh whenever I hear people talk about my books as not being violent because, you know, I mean, they do involve, like, blood sacrifice and torture and whatnot. So I always have to crack up.
No, I wouldn't. I kind of get where the question's coming from, but also I'm just kind of like, did we read the same book? Because I was in tears.
No, but Robin, if you're listening to this, no, I do understand where the question is coming from because it is true. I mean, I don't, you know, I think I I smacked Justin down one time because he was talking about something about swords in my books, and I was like, there is no sword. There are no swords. Nobody is carrying a sword in my book because, yeah, I don't know. I think I had at least wanted to get away from the big armies and battles sort of thing. Cause not that I enjoy reading military fantasy actually, but to me, the part I really find most interesting is the personal impact of violence, I guess you might say, or adventures, you know, or whatever. So I wanted to write this story that was just focused on these two guys kind of struggling to survive and navigate these difficult situations. And so I didn't want to have that epic scope of big battles and armies. And as far as the amount of fights, I guess because my world isn't really meant to be medieval. It's kind of more like an equivalent to the 17th or 18th century sort of thing, except for they don't have as much gunpowder and they're not carrying flintlock rifles around because they've got all this magic that has kind of done what technology would have been able to do in our world. So there's not as much of a drive to, say, develop an electric light bulb if you've got mage lights that work just fine. So they tend to use charms and magic as weapons. Even the people who aren't mages, because in Nineveh, the city, the main city in the book, magic is so freely available. There hasn't been as much of a drive toward technology in that way. So the question is, if you're using magic and stuff like that, well, you know, if you've got charms that can ward off impacts and things like this, I mean, you're not going to be, I mean, knives aren't going to be quite as useful. Nobody's going to be waving a sword around because if you've got a charm that can kill from a distance, sort of like a gun, you know, if you have a fight between a swordsman and somebody
Don't
with
bring
a pistol,
a knife to well, a magic
yeah, exactly. So, but that said, there's still, I would agree, not that much physical fighting in the books. And again, I think that's for me a thing of I was more interested in exploring adventures that don't necessarily involve that because there is a lot of, you can have a lot of tension and drama with just, I don't know, well, the scenes in the mountains in the first book or trying to figure out how you're going to, like in the second book, you know, Dev is stuck in this situation where all these guys are mages and he has no power, you know, he has no magic ability to help him or whatever. And so it's definitely not a case where he can be the biggest badass. He's got to figure out how to navigate this situation when he is the person with the least power. And so to me, that's really interesting is like, how do you go up against this idea that you're the total underdog in this situation? You have no way of overpowering your enemies. You have to figure out something and be sneaky. And I kind of like that. I've always liked books that the people have to be sneaky, or at least that it's really challenging for them to overcome an obstacle. So that's why, you know, well, obviously, Kieran isn't any good at fighting, but Dev isn't really either. I think in the first book, I have him say that, you know, he learned a little bit after his change when he didn't have the psychic power that he had as a child, you know, to help him anymore. But he was always busy climbing and doing stuff in the mountains. He wasn't getting into fights as much. So he, you know, I mean, he knows how to throw a punch and whatever, but he's certainly not, you know, how most, a lot of fantasy books these days are, the main character is this big assassin badass who can totally kick everyone's ass. And I'm like, no, you know, it's more interesting to me to figure out what happens if you're not the the big assassin badass. I mean, I guess you could argue that Kieran is a badass in terms of his magical potential, but he is restricted, much like Dev, in this. I put him in these situations where he can't use a lot of his magical potential for various reasons. And so, again, he has to figure out a different way to get what he wants than just, you know, throwing his magic around.
The second question was, since I saw on your website that you're a climber, I assume the mountain scenes in the books are based, at least in part, on your own experiences. Honestly, my palms sweat just reading the climbing scenes. Have you ever gotten scared on a climb, or are you utterly fearless like Dev seems to be? What's your favorite trip that you've ever done in the mountains? It's an easy question. Come on.
Well, no, the utterly fearless one is the easy question, because here's my answer to that one. I am not utterly fearless. My great secret, you know, everybody's like, oh, you're such a mountaineer, blah, blah. And I am, but I am like the world's most weenie mountaineer. I am very, very cautious. I am not at all, like, Deb would be mocking me if we were climbing together. Because, I do not have a very high risk tolerance. And people say, what are you talking about? You know, you climb these mountains and you ski these couloirs and everything. I'm like, well, yeah, but I always do the things that I know are within my ability. And I work up slowly to increasing my ability. And you can't get good at something as fast as if you are just completely charging it. Like, I remember my husband, when he came to Colorado, and he knew how to ski, because in Australia they do actually have skiing, believe it or not. But that's where he's from. But when he came here and he started to learn to ski powder as opposed to ice, what they have in Australia, he would just charge down the slope and like these moguls. And yeah, so he got developed like really great style much faster than I did. But the point is, we both ski the same runs now. It's just that, you know, it would take me at first a little bit longer to get down them because I was being more careful. And I would point out that I have never had an injury in climbing or skiing or whatever, whereas my husband has broken both his thumbs, and he's broken his rib, and he's whacked his knee really badly. So you can be an expert skier and to some extent an expert climber and whatever without doing crazy things. But I get scared. And, you know, there's been a lot of situations in the mountains where I was, you know, kind of terrified as I was doing whatever it was that I was doing. But as long as I'm reasonably sure that I'm not doing something crazy, like I don't free solo climb like Dev does. That would be the sort of climbing without a rope. I do not solo things without ropes. I always use ropes, that kind of thing. And like I said, that's not to say that I haven't gotten into situations where I was like, ho, you know, this is sketchy. But I don't do it to quite the level that Dev does in the book. And that was one of the fun things about writing Dev, is that saying that, hey, I know a lot of people that are like this, that climb without any regard to their personal safety, that really enjoy the being on the edge like that. And so it's fun to write a character like that when you're not like that yourself, to say, hey, this is a really interesting way of looking at the world, and I'd like to look at the world this way for a little bit and see what it's like. So as for the favorite trip I've ever done in the mountains, several years ago, before my son was born, my husband and I did a portion of what's known as the Sierra High Route, which the Sierra Nevada mountains in California, they're what I based the mountains in the books on. They're my favorite mountains in the whole world because they're a geologically young mountain range, so they're very pretty and jagged, and the rock is all this beautiful white sparkly granite, and it's great to climb on, and nice and solid, and just really spectacular peaks. And the weather is gorgeous, which is unusual for many mountain ranges. The Sierra Nevada, you can just have weeks of beautiful days in the summer without having to worry about thunderstorms or anything to be dangerous. And anyway, there's a route that this guy named Steve Roper put together that is mostly off trail. It's all above timberline, and it runs most of the length of the Sierra Nevada. It takes about 5 or 6 weeks to do if you're doing the whole thing, and I didn't have that kind of vacation time. But we took, I don't know, a week or two to do a portion of it with a friend of ours, a friend of mine from college who is the sort of climber like Dev, who just, you know, climbs whatever, without a rope. He's crazy, but it's really fun to be on trips with him. And yeah, so we did this trip, and it was just beautiful, in terms of the scenery that we saw and the challenges that we had getting over these passes that are above timberline. And Jason, our friend, that's the serious climber, he climbed all sorts of stuff that I was like, you know, you got to be kidding me. things that I would never go up, but we climbed some stuff too. And we did have to cut the trip short a little bit because there was this huge hurricane down in Baja California that, every time an arm of the hurricane swept over California, these thunderstorms would happen. And like I said, it doesn't happen very often in this area that you get these thunderstorms. But when you do, boy, you are above tree line. There is no shelter. So actually the scene in the Whitefire Crossing where, Dev and Kieran are, in the canyon with the convoy, and there's a thunderstorm, and there's this, like, the lightning strikes the other side and this rock fall goes down on the other side. And you know, they're thinking, well, Dev is thinking anyway, well, boy, if that had been our side, we would have been screwed. Yeah, that was totally off of that trip where we were up high in this cirque and there was this thunderstorm and we're like huddling under this rock on the edge of the cirque, and we see this lightning strike on the other side, enormous rock fall. And it was incredible. And these rocks were the size of like houses coming down the face. And we're like, whoa, if that had been on our side, we would be a little splat, you know, a little squished bugs right now. But we weren't, and so we lived to tell the tale. And that's the fun part about the mountains, is you see all this crazy stuff, but as long as you come back alive, it's all good.
Note to self, never climbing a mountain. Not ever. For any reason. No.
They're not all like that.
I'm such a wimp. I can't handle it. Okay. third question is, I really liked the character of Lena in The Tainted City. Will we get to see more of her in the third book? Any other hints you care to drop about the story? I am also interested in this question, so feel free to elaborate.
Yeah, you will get to see more of her, and that's more of Martin as well, and most of the characters that survived anyway, after the first two books. Hints that I care to drop about the story. I always don't like to spoil things for people, but I will say that I laughingly think of this book as, you know, the book where Kieran finally gets some agency, where, by which I mean that, you know, poor guy, the last two books, he's kind of been stuck in these situations.
He's kind of been like a rag doll.
I know, where he gets, you know, yeah, basically he has to be reactive a lot of the times in the first two books because he's so stuck in this situation where he's got so little power. And he's at the mercy of other people. Like in the first book, you know, I mean, he's made the decision to leave Nidavellir, but, you know, he's sort of at the mercy of Dev leading him across the mountains because he doesn't know how to cross the mountains himself. And anyway, things of that nature. And then, you know, he has problems with all these other mages that are much more powerful than he is. But in the third book, like I said, it's kind of, I think he'll get to see a little bit of Kieran getting to make some of his own choices without having them made for him. And yeah, and there'll be a bunch more adventure and working a little of my canyoneering fun that I've had in Utah into this book. And there'll be some new characters, and there'll be sorry, I'm trying to say this without spoiling like the end of the second one. You know, the conundrums that they're left in at the end of the second book are going to be addressed and eventually resolved. I mean, I consider this the final book of the trilogy. So in this one, I'm, you know, going for the big finish, I guess. So
does the series title become relevant? Do we find out what that means? Because
I hope so. Sorry, I was just thinking about the series title. I remember that was another thing, like we were talking about the pseudonym thing, I guess, before this podcast started. I mean, I don't write under a pseudonym, but I considered it, and there was all this back and forth. It was the same thing with the series title. They're like, hey, you need to come up with a series title. I was like, all right, you know. And I came up with like about five possibilities, and my agent nicked some of them, and I came up with about five more, and then I sent it off, and the Shattered Sigil was the one the publisher liked best. And I do know what it means, you know, I do. So I think it will be explained in this third book. So
you're very kind.
I know. I'm sorry. I never know how much people actually want to know about
all the things.
Yeah.
All of them.
Because I don't want to, you know, spoil anything. And also, if I say something
out, am I going to have to, like, send my therapy bills after I finish the third book? Is that going to be a thing that happens?
You know, I mean, I like to think that it's going to be a happy ending, but I sometimes wonder if our definitions of happy endings are different. So,
It's quite likely that they are.
okay, I'll be honest. I am not the sort of person that is. I mean, I don't think that you can have a great victory without cost. It doesn't make sense to me in a book for, well, in a book of this style. I mean, you can obviously have books where it's all lighthearted and fun or whatever, but. I mean, in this book where they've been struggling for so long, you know, to for Kieran to find freedom and for Dev to find safety for not only himself but, you know, the people he loves, to achieve that and not have there be some cost to the characters, I think feels a little bit to me like cheating. So it's not to say that everything's going to be totally easy for them or whatever, but I like to think that when the series ends, that that they're both in a place where they can achieve happiness.
So I'm gonna end up writing like fic to fix this. So, like I'm gonna end up having to write threesome fic where they're live happily ever after in the mountains. That's what you're telling me.
See, I want to say things, but I don't because.
You're like, no, Renee, stop trying to butter me up. I'm not giving you anything.
No, well, you know, and also, I mean, I still have 10 scenes to go, so I haven't written the very last scene yet, so.
Okay, you're off the hook then. So the last question from Robin is there any news at all on when the next book will come out? I want more of Dev and Kieran so badly. Good luck. I saved the best one for last.
Yes, well, you know, I just had like three coworkers ask me today, like as I was one in the cafeteria, one in the hall, you know, so is the third book out yet? I'm like, well, if only my company would pay me to write the third book instead of to do my actual day job, it would go out much faster. But, you know, I don't have any official news in that I can't give you an official release date. The book is still not on contract, but that's not, I mean, that's just because, for those who don't know, my original publisher, Nightshade Books, was bought out by two other publishers earlier this year. And The Labyrinth of Flame, which is the third Shattered Sigil book, was not under contract. It was an option book, meaning originally that Nightshade had right of first refusal on it. We had to like say yes or no to their offer before we could shop it somewhere else. Now they're out of option now on that book, or so my agent says, which means that we could technically shop it around wherever. But we were just kind of hanging back to see how the new people did with the imprint, you know, because it's always a little weird with new people buying out your publisher, and the new company did not have that much experience in the science fiction and fantasy market. So I've been seeing what's going on, and you know, we'll just my agent and I are going to talk pretty soon about what we want to do with the book. And I will say it's going to come out. It's just a question of is it going to go out, for instance, through Start and Skyhorse, which are the Skyhorse, particularly the publisher that bought out Nightshade, or is it going to be a situation where I'll just do a Kickstarter and put it out myself? I'm not sure. And it'll depend on a lot of things, you know, business, boring business related things. I am closing in on the end of my first draft of it. It's a much rougher first draft than I've ever written before, so it's going to need a fair amount of revision. It's my hope to really, really finish the book, you know, kind of by sometime early to mid next year. And then from there, we'll just have to see. I mean, if I did a Kickstarter, I might be able to put it out in fall of next year. If it's with the publisher, it might be longer than that. I don't know. It just depends on what their publishing schedule is. So all that's, again, a really long-winded way of saying, I'm sorry, I can't tell you exactly when the book is coming out, but I swear I'm working really hard on it. And I hope that the wait will be worth it, that you will enjoy the further adventures of Dev and Kieran. And probably once I actually finish for real, the draft of the book, I'm you know, revise it and everything, put it through the critique group and all that. I do want to write a couple short stories about things in that world to kind of help tide people over until the actual book comes out. So at the very least, might have a couple of those coming out on my website or something, maybe mid next year, something like that. You won't have to wait forever to have more of Dev and Kieran. Although the short stories that I would write would probably not be directly in the timeline of the book it might be. Like, there's been one I've been wanting to write for ages that's about Dev. Well, not about Dev specifically, but about the Taint Thieves, like when he was a Taint Thief, like a situation from there. He wouldn't be the protagonist of the short story, but he would be a character in it. So stuff like that, you know, stuff from their past, stuff from, you know, the world with them in it. I don't know, those kinds of things I might write some short stories about, so.
So I always make the people who come on to talk about themselves, I bring them bring Rex. So I was watching your meltdown over like which person to cut from your Rex list. I'm like, just keep it. It's fine. And the rules are not set in stone. This is not a professional podcast. Like, I'm interested in the person that you were thinking about cutting. I saved them 11th hour.
Well, ironically, you know, since that, I, like, rearranged them all, so now that person isn't there anymore.
Oh, good. Of course. Of course.
Although I could tell you who it was.
Yeah, no, you need to tell me. I need to know who I saved.
No, that's right. No, I was agonizing. The person that I was agonizing at that time on Twitter, because I guess for anybody listening to this who doesn't know, Renee had said, oh, bring, like, 1 to 4 book recs. And, oh, my gosh, it's so hard to, like, choose between all the books that I love. And then I was, like, trying to be, like, well, should I be, like, you know, tailor them to what I think Renee would enjoy? Or should I, like, pick based on recent books? Or, you know, it's so hard to narrow down to just a couple. So I'd gotten it down to, like, 5. And then I was, like, on Twitter going, I can't get it down to 4. How do I choose? Blah, blah, blah. And, at that time, I think the list had Joan. Oh dear, I'm going to mispronounce her last name. I think she pronounces it Vinge, Joan Vinge, V-I-N-G-E, Snow Queen and Summer Queen duology. That's from the '80s, early '80s. I think the first one won the Hugo Award actually, but I love those books and I think they're a great example of female authored space opera, you know, kind of science fiction stuff. But I took them off my official list because Joan hasn't been writing actively for quite some time. I thought, well, I can give some more love to the people who are still actively writing at this time, whether they're veteran authors or new authors. So to launch into my official 5 recommendations, the first one is based a little bit on addressing what Renee might enjoy, because I know that Renee, you enjoyed Ancillary Justice quite a bit.
Yes,
and
perfect.
So I don't say that this book is like Ancillary Justice, but I think it is interesting for some of the same reasons that Ancillary Justice is interesting. So the book is Bone Dance by Emma Bull. And I will just break off here to say that, I mean, Emma Bull, I love everything that she's ever written. And the interesting thing to me is that she doesn't written very many things, but they've always been very far ahead of the trend, kind of. Like, she wrote one of the seminal works of urban fantasy, War for the Oaks, way before urban fantasy was a thing. And then she wrote, like, this Western fantasy called Territory, way before Joe Abercrombie and everybody else started writing, you know, fantasy Westerns. So I always figure if I want to know what fantasy is doing, going to be doing in like 10 years, I should look at what Emma Bull is writing now. But anyway, this book, Bone Dance, it's a science fiction kind of quasi cyberpunk dystopian post-apocalyptic sort of thing. But the interesting thing about it and the reason that I compare it in a way to Ancillary Justice is that, and I apologize, this is a tiny bit of a spoiler to say this, but the main character is androgynous and the different characters in the book react to them differently based on whether they think the character is male or female. And I think Bull does a really interesting job of handling that, kind of subtly addressing some of the ways that we look at gender and how we allow it to influence our actions and decisions. And so I think in that way, it makes kind of a good pair with Ancillary Justice because, you know, obviously Anne Leckie was also looking at some of those questions. And I think Anne Leckie was looking at it in a much more overt way than Emma Bull was looking at it, but I do think that Bone Dance is interesting for that respect. And it's actually, I mean, like I said, I love everything that she's written. It's not my favorite of her books. I like others better, but everything that she's written is so good, especially for her treatment of character. I feel like everything I learned about how to make awesome characters, I learned from reading Emma Bull books. You know, if you can find like Falcon, which is her debut novel, and like any debut novel, it has flaws or whatever, kind of, she did some weird structural things, but oh my goodness, the characters are so amazing. So if you're, it's another good space opera, a pilot that's bonded to a ship. So again, sort of like Ancillary Justice, except not. Let's see. And then second recommendation, I will go for Carol Berg, because I think she is just criminally underappreciated in epic fantasy. She has been writing book after book after book after book that is just brilliant, and people rarely talk about her. And so I'm like, ah, you people, you don't know what you're missing. So specifically, which of hers is my favorite? Her Lighthouse duet, which is two books called Flesh and Spirit and Breath and Bone. They're epic fantasy, although with a very personal focus. She writes first person narrators mostly, and you know, single first person narrators point of view. So you get that kind of intimate feel at the same time as she's addressing, you know, these big magical world changing things. So I kind of like that mix, I guess. That's one of the things, like I talked about with my books, that I like, is having that kind of personal focus. The main character, who's the POV narrator, and Lighthouse Dwight, is great. He's, you know, he definitely starts off as a bit of kind of like a selfish jerk or whatever, but you know, like any good book, he grows and changes through it. And he's just got this really great sense of humor, really snarky. I like it. And for anybody who likes Dev and Kieran's kind of reluctant friendship in my books, her debut trilogy, the Rykira books that start with transformation, she has kind of a similar thing, not exactly, but a thing going on there with these two guys who are in very different stations in life. One is a prince and the other is a slave, and they the slave guy actually is the one with magic. And anyway, they end up forming this whole reluctant but very powerful friendship. And so if you like that kind of thing in books, I would go for those as well. So Emma Bull and Carol Berg were kind of my two veteran authors that I think are just so underappreciated, and more people should read them. So then I also wanted to talk about some newer authors. So one book that I would choose that was a relatively recent one that I thought was really interesting and unique was Mechanique by Genevieve Valentine. Came out a couple years ago. I want to say maybe in 2011. If anybody here has ever watched the TV show Carnival, which was this really really interesting and kind of dark circus set show, just with some really great characters, and this is kind of like that book in the sense that it's set in this circus. It's kind of steampunk, but the real strength of the book for me is the characters and the emotional interactions between them. And she does some really interesting things with point of view in the book. It's just so hard to describe because it's really a unique story, and the way that she told it is unique. And again, I haven't seen as much. It got a little bit of buzz when it came out. It might have even gotten some award nominations. I can't remember. But I don't see people talking about it as much now. And I'm like, wait, you people, there was this great book. Don't forget. Because I think The Night Circus came out not too long after. And a lot of people heard about that one because that was, you know, published as mainstream, Aram Morgenstern. And I thought The Night Circus was good. I enjoyed it. But I thought Mechanique was just amazing. So for anybody who enjoys circus books or steampunk books or books that are unusual in terms of point of view and choices of character, yeah, go for this one. Another recent author that I wish more people would read her book is Teresa Frohawk's Miserere, An Autumn Tale. She and I, our books came out about the same time, both from Nightshade. And so I read hers, I think, in ARC form. And I remember thinking when I read it, I was like, oh, yay, I'm so glad to be with a publisher who publishes like these awesome books like this, because I really thought it was great. It's one of those ones that's kind of hard to classify because it is mostly set in this alternate world thing where there's these different bastions of the different religions and from Earth. And there's these... yeah, there's like hell and heaven and angels and all these kind of things. So it uses Christian imagery in that way, but it's not at all what you would call like a Christian science fiction book. It's not like that. It's just she uses the religious imagery to kind of inform her story.
Bible fanfic. That's a category. It's people who use religion but don't like use it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even go that far because, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not that it's just about the Bible. It's like it's got all the other religions in it, too, because what I liked about the book and what I thought made it so interesting and unique to me was that was not all this stuff, but the fact that her characters in the book mostly are older, like 40s or whatever. They have this history with each other, and they're not all like that. There is this 12-year-old girl who comes over from our world or whatever, but the story isn't really hers. It's the other point of view characters, specifically Lucien and his twin sister Katerina, who is kind of the villain of the book. And Lucien himself has done these, you know, done some terrible things, and he's or what he perceives, you know, as terrible things, betraying the woman he loves, and because he couldn't break this bond to his twin. What I like about it is that, you know, so much of fantasy, and my books are no exception, you know, focuses on young characters, right? If they're not like 18, they're like in their 20s or whatever, they're making their way in the world or whatever. And Therese's characters, they have this weight of history behind them. They've had these interactions with each other, and it informs everything about what they do and everything about who they are. And it's about this struggle to overcome your past a bit and kind of find redemption, not in a cheesy way, but in a coming to peace with who you are and what you have done. Because, I mean, we've all done things that we regret. I mean, whether or not they're to the level that maybe Therese's characters, but there's always that how do I come to be at peace with myself and how my actions reflect the sort of person that I am, that I want to be. And I think Therese's book addresses that from a mature perspective, and I really thought it was really interesting in that way. Also, you know, her writing is great, and it's not a super long book for anybody who's like, oh, these epic fantasies are all so long, you know, or whatever. Like, Therese's book isn't long at all. I don't remember exactly how long it was, but certainly, I don't know, like around 100,000 words or something like that. So something that and it works as a standalone too, although she may one day write some more in the same world, is a good one to pick up if you're looking for something that's not going to suck up, you know, like months of your time. Okay, so then my final recommendation, I wanted to pick one YA novel because I read a lot of YA, especially when I'm working on writing my books, because like I said, I can read it quickly. And I agonized because, boy, I've read so many great YA books this year. But the one that I would pick out is one that I thought was really excellent, but I haven't seen people talking about, is Catherine Fisher's Obsidian Mirror. I can't remember if it's The Obsidian Mirror or just Obsidian Mirror. I just, you know, I think she's amazing. And why I think it was amazing, I mean, not only she's really inventive, and she's written other stuff too. It was in Carceron that I first read by her, that just, I picked the book up while my son was playing with some trains in a toy store. And I read like the first page and I knew I had to buy it like right then. because she's so great with the character stuff. I know, Renee, in the past you've talked about liking books that are subtle, that make the reader work. Yeah. And I think this is very much a case of that. What she does is she portrays enough of the characters so that you can kind of get into what they're feeling and their emotions, but you don't know why necessarily at first they're doing the things that they're doing. And as the story unfolds, it's kind of like peeling back an onion of layers of motivation. And like, you as the reader need to work to figure out, do you think, why you think this character is doing these things, you know? And so I like that aspect of it. I think it puts some people off. So Obsidian Mirror, going back to that specific book, it's really inventive in the way that it combines, it's got like this time traveling girl from a dystopian future, and it's got this guy and kind of like a more, this guy who believes that his uncle has killed his father, and they've got this kind of, I don't know, almost steampunky technology sort of thing that allows them to travel worlds. And then on top of that, it's got this fairy wood around the house where there's this changeling kid that's stuck, you know, under the rule of the fairy queen. And she puts all these elements together and just does it so well. I read this book and I was just blown away. And I was like, you know, if I wrote YA ever, this is the kind of YA that I would want to write, where it's just, it's really neatly dovetailed with the plot and the character interactions are so great and all this. And then I went on Goodreads and looked, and like everybody else was like, huh, you know, meh, I didn't like this. And I was like, yeah, and this is why I don't write YA, because the kind of YA I write, like, nobody would like.
The endless problem of wanting to write YA but realizing that it's probably not marketable to the same demographics.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of that is that she doesn't really focus on romance very much in her YA. And so, you know, you lose that audience, I guess. And part of it is that she does have this kind of distancing effect in her books, where you've got to work as the reader to understand everything that's going on. And some people don't like that, I think. But anyway, I really thought it was great, and I highly recommend it, and I barely see anybody talk about it. So you all should go read Obsidian Mirror. It is, I will warn people, it's the first in a series of, I forget how many, and it does end on the sort of note where you're like, where is the second book? Oh my gosh. That said, you all should read it anyway, so that there will be more books, because what I've learned as an author is that if everybody waits for the series to be finished before they read it, there will be no rest of the series, because the publisher will say, gosh, that first book didn't sell, I'm not going to buy any more. I know why people wait to have the completed series, and I totally understand it. But it's just funny that, like, as an author, the worst shelving on Goodreads that you can see somebody do for your book is waiting for a completed series. You know, and you're like, no, you don't understand. I'm not going to have a completed series if nobody buys my first book. But that's, you know, that's the way it goes for authors. Like I said, I certainly understand the desire to wait until you have all the books in hand, especially with these days with people kind of taking forever with their series. And
we're not going to name any names, though.
Yes, yes, yes.
No, I'm sorry. I'm totally patient. I can wait. It's fine. Take your time. No stress. Self-care.
Well, I admit, after I finished the second one and everything, I had to tell my agent. I was like, you know, I don't know if I can keep up this pace because I would really like to stay married, and I'm not sure that I will be able to if I have to keep writing like this way. Because, yeah, to finish The Tainted City on time, I basically, any spare second that I wasn't working or taking care of my son, I was writing. And, yeah, my husband was getting like, hello, do I even have a wife, you know? So
No, I have checked out. Please submit your application at a later date.
Yeah, which, you know, I mean, that's okay to do for, like, a little while, but for, like, months.
Yeah, no good, no.
So anyway, I'm trying to have a slightly better life balance with this one, even if it means, and so unfortunately, that you all have to wait a little bit longer for
but
it.
But I can't suck you into fandoms. Oh.
Not until I'm done, so.
None of that. It's open season. It's Tumblr, Supernatural. I have your number and your email.
That's right.
Thank you for coming and talking about, you know, books and fandom with me. I really had a good time.
Yeah, no problem. I enjoyed it. And
thanks for coming on, and I hope to have you on again when your book comes out and we can talk about it.
That's right. We'll have to have the All Spoiler All the Time podcast after three are out, and then you can be all, what were you thinking when you did this, and why didn't you?
And I can just cry openly on the podcast. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.